with a sympathetic friend or a good therapist, or at least a Valium to get to the root of the matter, but instead dash around with drawn swords. In short, a collection of paranoid hysterics who refuse to live like sensible adults. And as for moving toward a given end with a perfection far into human nature, what real royal court has, short of armed revolution or war, suffered the simultaneous and total extermination that happens in Elsinore at the end of Hamlet? The farce that is presented in Petruchio's wooing of Kate and in the efforts of Tranio and Biondello to win Bianca for their master Lucentio deserves a positive description. That farce arises, as I said in the previous lecture, from a relatively realistic situation. Bianca's popularity and Baptista's preference for her credibly motivates Kate's shrewish behavior. Baptista's effort, within the realistic circumstances of the upper middle class in Elizabethan times, to even the odds between his popular daughter and the unwanted elder sister, by vowing that Bianca shall not marry before Kate does, only creates a frustrating stalemate for everybody concerned, for himself, for his daughters, and for Bianca's suitors. Within this situation, farce does something positive. It celebrates three virtues: energy, ingenuity, and resilience. Virtues that disrupt the static dilemma in Padua and work to resolve it. The energy is obvious in the eagerness of the male characters who arrive in Padua. Petruchio, Tranio, Lucentio. And the way they take on a set of problems regarded by the Paduans as hopeless. And the demands they confidently make upon themselves that in solving those problems. The energy is verbally elaborated in Petruchio's speeches. He boasts of his career amid roaring lions and clanging trumpets. Ingenuity, that is mental independence and resourcefulness, lies in the suitor's adoption of unconventional means to gain their ends. Notably in Petruchio's behavior at the wedding, and above all, his great pretense of being a worse shrew than Kate. But also in the fertile inventiveness of Lucentio and his servants in the Bianca plot. And the third quality, resilience, by that I mean a special combination of stubbornness and adaptability. This is a virtue that often occurs in farcical characters, but most people don't recognize it as a virtue. We're too ready to describe farce as mechanical or rigid. The ability to endure or initiate repeated confrontations, pratfalls, beatings, can be testimony to the determination of the characters to get what they're after. And the determination loses any mechanical quality it might have when it is combined with the cleverness, the ready resourcefulness displayed by Petruchio in the taming and the numerous schemes that Tranio comes up with. In civilized life, of course, adults avoid the shouting and the knockabout that is characteristic of farce. We don't go in for that sort of physical activity. But the energy, the ingenuity, the resilience, these three virtues embodied in such activities are valuable qualities. We do not honor lassitude, or mental barrenness, or defeatism. Now, so far I have attributed these farcical virtues only to male characters. That indeed is one of the complaints that feminist critics have made about this play. A distinguished Shakespearean at Brown University, my friend Capella Khan, has weighed in particularly strongly and has written in print and said to me personally, "Farce, Peter, is a kind of theatrical elaboration of male fantasies of domination over women." And I have answered, "But Capella, Kate is also a farceur, or farceuse, if you want to put it in French properly. Her verbal and physical energy in resisting humiliation make her the interesting and attractive person that she is. That's why she's so striking in her first two scenes. In her third scene, when she meets Petruchio, it is she who initiates both the physical brawling and the verbal combat. Now, at that point in the play, her behavior has a strain of compulsiveness to it that the men, the male farceurs, do not have. She has the energy, but her resilience is more stubborn than it is adaptable. And she relies very heavily on the threat of physical violence, or the outright use of physical violence. But that's precisely the point. Her liberation from raging shrewishness, from compulsiveness and destructiveness, is marked by her growth in farcical range, in range of the activities of farce. What Petruchio teaches her, essentially, or what she learns from Petruchio, because it's really a matter of her observation and picking it up and learning to practice it herself. What he teaches, what she learns, is play. Play. This is the central activity and the dominating metaphor of The Taming of the Shrew. Play. Game. Pastime. You remember the whole thing is a play, literally, the Lord's play put on for the entertainment of the tinker Christopher Sly. And the play contains a gallery of games. Bianca's suitors put on disguises and play roles in order to woo her. Grumio plays games with Kate's hunger when they get back to Petruchio's country house. He offers her beef, mustard, and she's so hungry, she says, both, either. And Grumio says, well, then I'll give you the mustard without the beef. Petruchio plays games with words. I am content. You shall entreat me stay, and yet not stay. That is, I'm content that you're begging me. I'm not going to listen to your begging, but I'm glad about that you're doing it. The first courtship is a very elaborate verbal game with some astonishingly filthy metaphors going on. I won't go into them at the moment. The master game is, of course, Petruchio's sustained pretense of being a worse shrew than Kate is. Through this game, he acts a parody of Kate's ill temper. He holds the mirror up to her faults until she realizes what she's been like, what her effect on other people has been. Now, Kate originally could not play games. Everything was deadly earnest. For that, she herself was not wholly responsible. Bianca pretends to be meek and humble. Kate sees through that, as a sister will. But everybody else is taken in, so it infuriates Kate that Bianca is getting away with this. Baptista is too biased toward Bianca and not intelligent enough to think how to cope with Kate. Kate is interested in men. We can tell that from the scene between her and Bianca, where she jealously asks Bianca about her suitors and which of the suitors she, Bianca, favors. But she herself, Kate, hasn't met any man yet who can command her respect, who is intelligent enough to cope, strong enough to stand up to her. So she lives in uncivilized anger, shrewishness. She is cursed. That's an adjective that is used several times in the play as a synonym for shrewish. It means bad-tempered, cantankerous. But it also can mean under a curse, suffering from a curse, the victim of a curse. An accursed, angry person cannot play. And if you can't play, you're not fully human. The ability to play is one of the marks of being human. Now, she is slowly released from this by the development of her interest in Petruchio. And it's difficult in Act 2 and 3 to trace that interest. There is very little given her to say that would mark it. And most actresses do it by looking at Petruchio at odd moments when he's not looking at her. But there are a few things in the lines. When Petruchio, at the end of the courting scene, swiftly arranges the marriage with Baptista, Kate protests, but not very long. Then when Petruchio is late for the wedding itself, she is not relieved, as she would be if she really disliked him, or had no interest in him. Nor is she immediately angry, as the hero of the other heroine of the other Elizabethan shrew play is. She's embarrassed, almost as if she were disappointed. In Acts 4 and 5, however, the development of her mind is quite carefully traced. The first step is compassion. Compassion for the victims of Petruchio's temper tantrums. When Petruchio beats Grumio for being responsible for the horse falling in the mire, she tries to pluck Petruchio off Grumio's back. We don't see that because you can't put horses in mud on the stage, but we hear about it. But we do see the episode when a servant accidentally spills some water, and Petruchio beats that servant, and Kate tries to intervene there. Patience, I pray you. 'Twas a fault unwilling. The second step on her part is perplexity, puzzlement, a sense that something is going on she hasn't quite grasped. I am starved for meat, giddy for lack of sleep, with oaths kept waking and with brawling fed, and that which spites me all than all these wants, he does it in the name of perfect love. What is he doing? What does it mean? So she resorts once more to anger and to a kind of super common sense, an insistence on plain fact. Hey, look, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, not 7 o'clock in the evening. What are you talking about? And finally, she sees what is going on, that Petruchio is playing a game, that she has married a gamester who in his game playing can revise the whole world. And that is what happens in the key scene of the play, the scene when they are on their way back to Padua for Bianca's wedding. They're on the road. And Petruchio says, "Come on, a God's name, once more toward our fathers. Good Lord, how bright and goodly shines the moon." The moon? It is not moonlight now. 'Tis the sun. I say it is the moon that shines so bright. I know it is the sun that shines so bright. Now, by my mother's sun, and that's myself, it shall be moon or star or what I list or ere I journey to your father's house. Ah, always crossed, nothing but crossed. Hortensio tries to intervene and says to Kate, "Say as he does, or we shall never go." And Kate says, "Forward, I pray, since we have gone so far. And be it sun or moon or what you will, and if you please it to call it a rush candle, henceforth I vow it shall be so for me." Now the key thing is, if you please it to call it a rush candle. Not only has she agreed to go along with him, but she's kicked the ball into another court. She's exaggerated. A rush candle is the cheapest kind of candle you can get, a mere piece of rush stuck in some tallow or grease. If you call the glorious sun a rush candle, you're willing to go along with anything. I say it is the moon. I know it is the moon. Then God be blessed. It is... No, Petruchio says. Nay, then you lie. It is the blessed sun. He's changed the rules again. Then God be blessed. It is the blessed sun. But sun it is not. when you say it is not, and the moon changes even with your mind. Now she's not only kicking the ball into another court, she's directly mocking him. The moon changes all the time, your mind changes all the time. You're just a giddy person. She's learned the game. So Petruchio immediately stages another game. In comes a very old man. And Petruchio greets him as if this were a beautiful young woman. Good morrow, gentle mistress, where away? Tell me, Kate, and tell me truly too, hast thou beheld a fresher gentlewoman? Such war of white and red within her cheeks. What stars do spangle heaven with such beauty as those two eyes become that heavenly face? Fair lovely maid, once more good day to thee. Sweet Kate, embrace her for her beauty's sake. Now, this is conventional Petrarchan praise. White and red in the cheeks, stars for eyes. This is the way a beautiful woman is talked about in the most conventional possible way. Kate tops him. Young budding virgin, fresh and fair and sweet. Whither away, and where is thy abode? Happy the parents of so fair a child. Happier the man whom favorable stars allots thee for his lovely bedfellow. Now, it is impossible to say to an old man, young budding virgin, on stage, and not get a howl of laughter. She's taken Petruchio's conventional phrase and exaggerated it so greatly that it becomes wonderful farce. Momentarily, it exhausts her. Her next line, whither away or where is thy abode, isn't very interesting. She's gagging. She's trying to think of what to say next. And then she comes up with it. The man who marries you is going to be enormously happy, who has thee for his lovely bedfellow. She's taken this old, withered man and shoved him into bed with some young stud as the perfect plaything. It's gorgeous. Why? How now, Kate, I hope thou art not mad. This is a man, old, wrinkled, faded, withered, and not a maiden, as thou sayest he is. Pardon, old father, my mistaking eyes, that have been so bedazzled with the sun. And any actress worth her salt is going to look back at Petruchio and say, is it the sun or the moon at this point? I know your games. I can play them as well as you. She has learned to improvise as well as he does, even better. The game releases her from her compulsiveness, from her anger, her insistence on literal fact. The game transforms her. Game or play has a cathartic effect. In play, human beings can master their circumstances and gain release from bondage to themselves. She can work out her antagonism and thus arrive at love. That is what really makes it possible, emotionally, for Kate to deliver the final speech on wifely submission to a husband. She has found a man worth submitting to. She takes pleasure in following his directions. Play has brought release and health. And clearly, the whole of The Taming of the Shrew is meant to do just that. The anonymous lord who stages The Taming of the Shrew with his company of actors for Christopher Sly the Tinker aims to bring, and this is a quotation from the opening scenes, mirth and merriment. This frame isn't at all necessary for Shakespeare's play. Many productions cut it out altogether since it's not complete in Shakespeare's text. But it does amplify the story of the shrew by providing a series of game transformations. Christopher Sly is turned into a lord. The lord's page boy is turned into Christopher Sly's wife. A play is put on. And so we are prepared for the transformation of Kate the Shrew into Kate the loving wife in the major play. All these things allow Shakespeare to reflect on his own great game, which is the theater. The theater is a place where actors play. where they say that the sun is the moon, particularly if they are playing in a London amphitheater in the 1590s, where the performances take place in the afternoon. But what they are doing is a play, say, called Romeo and Juliet, where Juliet appears on a balcony and says, "Oh, swear not by the moon, the inconstant moon that monthly changes in her circled orb." The theater is a place where a 13-year-old boy puts on a dress and pretends to be a young, budding virgin called Juliet or Kate or Bianca. And if we accept these games, if we accept that the sun is the moon and that the boy is Caterina Minola or Juliet Capulet, then we are transformed, at least for the duration of the play, and perhaps longer than that. But the game must be played well, with precision, with carefully elaborated detail. You can't do that if you're angry. Once she stops being angry, Kate becomes a very accomplished farceuse indeed. And she and Petruchio are playing a game in the final scene to dish the nasty relatives and to uphold their honor as a couple at her sister's wedding. They don't ask for the quarrel that starts the bet. It's imposed upon them, but they win it. Even as Kate and Petruchio elaborate the fantasy of the sun and the moon and the virgin old man, the anonymous lord elaborates the details of Christopher Sly's supposed madness and gives precise directions to the troupe of players. And if all goes well, the play is therapeutic. The play brings health. As Christopher Sly is told, "Your doctors thought it good you hear a play and frame your mind to mirth and merriment, which bars a thousand harms and lengthens life." Mirth and merriment bars harms. It makes you healthier. It extends your life. Comedy brings life. Shakespearean comedy does. Hello again. This is the first of two lectures on The Merchant of Venice. The Merchant of Venice is a fairy tale. Over 50 years ago, a great actor, director, and Shakespearean critic, Harley Granville Barker, said there was no more reality in Shylock's Bond and The Lord of Belmont's Will than there is in Jack and the Beanstalk. And he spoke wisely. In Belmont is a lady richly left. And not only is Portia rich, she is also beautiful, wise, virtuous, eminently desirable on all counts. But according to her late father's will, she can only be wooed by lottery. Her suitors must choose between three caskets of gold, silver, and lead, which contains her picture. And it's a pretty stiff lottery. The contestants must swear not only to abide by the results of the choice, but if they lose, never to woo a woman in way of marriage again. Choose the right box, and you win the princess and the fortune. Choose the wrong one, you go forever without love. If you take it from Bassanio's point of view, it is a story of outrageous wish fulfillment. He's a spendthrift, he's head over ears in debt, He persuades his friend to float one more loan for him, with which he buys clothes, presents, a new sports car. He tootles off to Vassar to woo the heiress, and she turns out not only to be rich and virtuous and beautiful, but she's madly in love with him. And on top of all that, after winning the lady, he never has to repay his friend for the loan, because the old Scrooge from whom they got the money is proved to be so villainous he doesn't deserve to have his ducats back. The other plot may seem more real. The casket story happens in Belmont, the beautiful mountain, a fairy tale place of love and music. The rest of the play happens in Venice, a commercial society and great power well known to many Elizabethans. Antonio is prosecuted for a large, unpaid debt, imprisoned, brought to trial, and to the point of death. But at the heart of this plot, too, there is a fairy tale motif. The loan, in which the collateral is a pound of the borrower's flesh. It's a grimmer sort of fairy tale. In fact, it is the kind of fairy tale that was collected in Germany in the 19th century by those two folk tale-loving brothers named Grimm. In Grimm's fairy tales, chopping up people and even eating them occurs fairly frequently. And there are lots of other improbabilities in this plot, too. Antonio loses all his ships at sea. That's why the debt cannot be repaid. And then he gets them all back again. Portia and her maid Nerissa go to Venice and appear in open courtroom disguised as men. And nobody perceives the reality underneath the disguise, even though their husbands are prominent in that courtroom. Now, Shakespeare was fond of fairy tales. He exploited them frequently. The ultimate wicked uncle, for example, is Richard III. King Lear's daughters are a version of Cinderella and her stepsisters. Midsummer Night's Dream, that's a play in which juice distilled from a flower and squeezed into the eyes of a sleeping young man will cause him, when he wakes up, to fall violently in love with someone quite different from the person he formerly adored. And often my students have asked me, what is the point of reading all this unrealistic stuff? Why should a rich man leave a will that disposes of his daughter and her fortune by lottery? Isn't it silly to think that our love depends on magic flower juice? And in the case of King Lear, a very great realistic writer indeed, Tolstoy, complained that it was far too much coincidence to suppose that King Lear had two utterly wicked daughters and one good one, and his best friend, the Earl of Gloucester, had one utterly wicked son and one good one, and they went through the same experiences with those children simultaneously. To all of which, I respond to my students that the purpose of art is not realism. Realism is one of the techniques that art uses. One of many. It happens to have been the principal technique used by a lot of late 19th and early 20th century art. The novelists like Tolstoy and Galsworthy and Dreiser, the playwrights like Ibsen and early O'Neill. But it is not a favored technique in Asian art, or African, or most medieval art, or modern painting. Shakespeare is occasionally realistic. That is, occasionally he imitates the surfaces of real life, surface verisimilitude. He will write a scene in prose for characters in a state of casual relaxation. But realism in that sense is not a principal artistic technique of Shakespeare's time either. And his characters are not novelistic depictions of real people. They are constructs. They are artifacts. They are embodiments of insights into the human condition. Thus, they are not realistic on the surface. As I've remarked in an earlier lecture, kings of England do not deliver speeches from the throne in blank verse. But they may be something better than realistic. they may be true. They may be true to the inner realities of our lives, the urges and energies of human beings, the forces within our psyches. And the plots are not realistic transcriptions of events, even when they're based on events from history. The plots arrange events artistically in order to reveal truths about human behavior. To go back to Portia's father's will. No, rich men don't leave documents setting up casket lotteries to dispose of their daughters. But fathers do care about the characters of young men who come courting their daughters and often try to find out in one way or another what the guy is really like. Is he interested in the daughter or only in the fortune? That is the inner reality that the casket story concerns. That is what Nerissa says to Portia in the first act. Your father was ever virtuous, and holy men at their deaths have good inspirations. Therefore, the lottery that he hath devised in these three caskets of gold, silver, and lead will no doubt never be chosen by any rightly but one whom you shall rightly love. The right chooser will be the right lover. So, let us look at the choosers in this play. The Prince of Morocco is the man of great reputation, proud of his military exploits. By this scimitar that slew the Sophy in a Persian prince that won three fields of Sophy Solomon, I would o'erstare the sternest eyes that look, outbrave the heart most daring on the earth, pluck the young sucking cubs from the she-bear, yea, mock the lion when he roars for prey, to win thee, lady. This is the heroical man, the man of hyperbole. This kind of rhetoric is not going to win Portia's hand. It might blow her out of the room. In fact, it's a very particular kind of rhetoric. The style had been invented 9 years earlier by Shakespeare's contemporary, Christopher Marlowe, to dramatize the story of Tamburlaine. Tamburlaine is one of those eastern conquerors with seven-league boots who crushes kingdoms with every stride and flattens opponents with every speech. Marlowe had a terrific theatrical success with Tamburlaine. He had found a new voice for the Elizabethan drama, and for a couple of years afterwards, practically every playwright in London wrote a Tamburlaine-type play, trying to cash in on the popularity of the mode. But by the mid-1590s, when Shakespeare is writing The Merchant of Venice, the Tamburlaine rhetoric had come to seem simple-minded, outdated. When Shakespeare uses it, it marks the limitations of a character rather than the character's strengths. We'll meet this kind of rant again in Hotspur, the northern border lord in Henry IV, who is indeed a very great warrior, but is totally out of his depth when it comes to politics or women. For the Prince of Morocco, his choice amongst those caskets is based precisely on this kind of boastful pride, his consciousness of worldly reputation. On the golden casket is written, "Who chooseth me will gain what many men desire." And Morocco says, "Why, that's the lady. All the world desires her. From the four corners of the earth they come to kiss this shrine, this mortal breathing saint. The Hyrcanian deserts and the vasty wilds of wide Arabia are as throughfares now for princes to come view fair Portia. The watery kingdom whose ambitious head spits in the face of heaven is no bar to stop the foreign spirits as they come as o'er a brook to view fair Portia." Well, that's exciting stuff. Ravishing stuff. And in fact, it's a direct imitation of one speech of Tamburlaine's about how he's going to entertain the woman he loves, to entertain divine Xenocrate. But listen to the sense of the words, as well as their enthusiasm. "From the four corners of the earth they come to view fair Portia. They cross lands, deserts, stormy seas to do so. Portia is desirable to Morocco because everybody else desires her. She is what men want. Therefore, I want her. Therefore, I'll gain her. But love, of course, is not simply a matter of seizing what you want. The second suitor, the Prince of Aragon, is a subtler man. He understands the temptation of gold and rejects it. Who chooseth me shall gain what many men desire. What many men desire. That many may be meant by the fool multitude that choose by show, not learning more than the fond eye doth teach, which pries not to the interior, but like the martlet builds in the weather of the outward wall, even in the force and road of casualty. I will not choose what many men desire, because I will not jump with common spirits and rank me with the barbarous multitude. Obviously, he's a snob. Now, a snob is a man who places a high value on himself and his own position in contrast with others. And that is the way Aragon chooses. He reads the label on the silver casket. Who chooses me shall gain as much as he deserves. And well said, too. For who shall go about to cozen fortune and be honorable without the stamp of merit? Let none presume to wear an undeserved dignity. Oh, that estates, degrees, and offices were not derived corruptly, and that clear honor were purchased by the merit of the wearer. How much low peasantry would then be gleaned from the true seed of honor, and how much honor picked from the chaff and ruin of the times to be new varnish? Well, to my choice. Who chooseth me shall gain as much as he deserves. I will assume desert. Give me a key for this. And what he finds inside is the picture of a blinking idiot. Now, some readers have thought that there's something modest in Aragon. He'll take no more than he deserves. But Shakespeare finds desert to be a questionable notion. We are all faulty in various ways. Portia, in the famous speech on mercy later in the play, observes that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We're all damned unless God gives us grace. Hamlet says the same thing in a snappier way when Polonius tells Hamlet he will look after the traveling players according to their desert. Hamlet suddenly has a temper tantrum. God's bodikin, man, much better. Use every man after his desert, and who would escape whipping? We all deserve to be thrashed. To claim desert is very risky, especially in love. A genuine lover, I should think, is delighted, even astonished that the object of his love returns his affection. We are humble in love. It is a surprise to discover that the person we find wonderful feels the same way about us. Indeed, neither Morocco nor Aragon is really thinking about Portia at all. Essentially, they choose themselves. Morocco chooses his own desire. Aragon, his own desert. Bassanio, on the other hand, understands that love is not just desire and is not desert at all. It involves looking beyond oneself and beyond the surface of other things to a reality that requires commitment. Now, I can't go straight for Bassanio's choice immediately. I've got to say something more generally about the character first. Shakespeare confronts a difficulty in characterizing Bassanio. He's going to win Portia. Portia is the protagonist of the play, the leading character, the heroine, and I suppose that makes Bassanio, ex officio, the hero. But the nature of the plot does not allow him to be very heroic. The story demands that his friend Antonio pledge a pound of flesh for his sake, and that puts Antonio in a position of risky heroism, but lets Bassanio rest as the passive recipient of favors. How can we say that he's an admirable man, the one whom Portia should rightly love? Now, this difficulty is a special case of a recurring trouble that happens in high comedy. High comedy is the realm of wit, of grace, of civilization, and chiefly has been the realm of women. The values of wit and grace and civilized behavior are very well expressed on stage by women. Men, of course, can be witty and graceful too, but in Western convention, men have been thought heroic when they go out and do something that calls for strength and courage. And high comedy doesn't allow much room for that. This certainly is the case with Shakespeare's romantic comedies. They celebrate the values of intelligence and courtesy and love, and Shakespeare gives the leading parts to the women. Portia, Rosalind, Viola, Helena. Despite the fact that in his theater, that means loading the weight of the play on the boy actor instead of giving it to Burbage, the leading actor of the company, who plays Hamlet and Lear and any king you want. In the histories and tragedies, the lead is always a man. Two women manage to get equal billing, Juliet with Romeo, Cleopatra with Antony, but they never take the lead. But in the comedies, As You Like It and Twelfth Night and The Merchant of Venice and All's Well That Ends Well, the female lead must carry the play. And it's less easy for the writer to demonstrate worth in her lover. It's a problem in dramatic strategy, a problem that Shakespeare went some distance towards solving when he wrote As You Like It. In As You Like It, he has Orlando win a wrestling match in the first act. That takes care of that. He's okay. And if it weren't enough, he rescues his brother's life from a lioness in the fourth act, off stage. So Rosalind can dominate the rest of the play. But some readers feel that Shakespeare never solved the problem with Bassanio. In fact, some have been very hard on Bassanio indeed, considering him a fortune hunter. He wants and needs Portia's money to pay his debts. Now, it's quite true that he needs the money, but it isn't the only thing that is true about him. I think it's short-sighted to consider him merely a fortune hunter. In Belmont is a lady richly left. That is the first thing he says about her. But he goes on, and she is fair, and fairer than that word of wondrous virtues. She is rich and beautiful and good. That's an incremental progression. To call him merely a fortune hunter is to ignore how Shakespeare writes about him and to ignore what he actually does in choosing the leaden casket. Shakespeare writes about him as if he were on a romantic quest, a knight errant out of ancient legend pursuing a glamorous goal. He is compared to the Greek hero, Jason, leading the Argonauts in search of the golden fleece. Portia's sunny locks hang on her temples like the golden fleece, which makes her seat of Belmont Colchis strand, and many Jasons come in quest of her. And that Jason reference recurs several times in the play. When Bassanio has chosen rightly, his friend Graziano says, "We are the Jasons. We have won the fleece." And Portia goes a step higher than Jason. She compares Bassanio to the greatest of the Greek heroes, Hercules. In this comparison, she herself is Hesione, the princess of Troy, who was one of those unfortunate maidens left out on a beach to be devoured by a monster because they defended the god Neptune. And Bassanio is the Hercules who comes along to rescue her. She says, "Now he goes, with no less presence, but with much more love than young Alcides," Alcides is another name for Hercules. Young Alcides, when he did redeem the virgin tribute paid by howling Troy to the sea monster. I stand for sacrifice. Go, Hercules. Live thou, I live. With much, much more dismay I view the fight than thou that makest the fray. And there's some basis for this extreme comparison. Portia is tied to the casket choice, and all the suitors who have come along so far, not only Morocco and Aragon, but six others whom we don't see, but whom Portia describes, are pretty rotten people. Portia is a rich woman, but being only a woman in a patriarchal society where women aren't allowed much initiative, she suffers the vulnerability as well as the popularity of an heiress. One of these stupid, arrogant, drunken men might just stumble over the right casket at some point, if only by accident. So by poetry, Shakespeare makes Bassanio something of a chivalric quester, rescuing a virgin in trouble. But the real heroism of Bassanio lies in the choice itself. That choice is preceded by a song, which I will recite to you. Tell me, where is fancy bred, or in the heart, or in the head? How begot, how nourished? Reply, reply. It is engendered in the eyes, with gazing fed, and fancy dies in the cradle where it lies. Let us all ring fancy's knell. I'll begin it, ding dong bell. Ding, dong, bell. Now, songs in Shakespeare are usually addressed to the audience. They make a thematic statement. Statement about a value that is important to the action that we're witnessing. In this case, the song tells us there's a mystery about love. Fancy is easily explained. Fancy is mere attraction, desire, being turned on by someone you find pretty, sexy. The British still use the word in this sense. Do you fancy her? Means, do you want to go to bed with her? Fancy is based merely on appearance. It's engendered in the eyes. It grows as you gaze on the beautiful person. And when this person ceases to be physically appealing to you, it dies. The implication of all that is that love, something more than fancy, something that lasts, is based not on appearance, not on qualities that can be seen, cannot be explained as a mere mechanism of desire. It's easy enough to see why somebody with movie star looks inspires a lot of lust. No one would dare explain why you fall in love with a particular person. Love involves discontinuity. It involves some kind of leap beyond the external qualities to some inner reality. Implicitly, that song I've quoted asks whether Bassanio is merely a fancier, like the other suitors, or a true lover. Bassanio responds to the test with a meditation explicitly distinguishing between reality and the false charms of appearance. So may the outward shows be least themselves. The world is still deceived with ornament. In law, what plea so tainted and corrupt, but being seasoned with a gracious voice, obscures the show of evil? In religion, what damned error but some sober brow will bless it and approve it with a text, hiding the grossness with fair ornament. There is no vice so simple but assumes some mark of virtue in its outward parts. How many cowards, whose hearts are all as false as stairs of sand, wear yet upon their chins the beards of Hercules and frowning Mars, who inward searched have livers white as milk. And on that basis, he rejects the appeal of the gold and the silver caskets and chooses meager lead, which rather threatenest than dost promise aught. He rejects mere appearance. He knows you have to go beyond it. He does understand what love is about as opposed to mere desire. In love, you have to leap. In fact, the nature of the leap is specified in the casket labels. Gold says, who chooses me shall gain what many men desire. But love is not mere desire, not mere chasing after whatever your hormones are excited by. The silver casket says, who chooses me shall get as much as he deserves. But love is not merited, deserved. It is bestowed. The lead casket says, who chooses me must give and hazard all he hath. In love, you give yourself. Love is a commitment of all you have. And in the age before divorce courts, love is something you cannot do with your fingers crossed. Bassanio is willing to make that commitment. He has the generosity to give himself. Now, the cynic may still respond, of course he gives himself. He's going to get Portia and her fortune. He wants that money. And he does. That's true. But the final point is that he doesn't take Portia and her fortune. Doesn't take them in any way that would validate the cynic's charge of fortune hunting. Because he has an act of generosity yet to perform in this scene of choice. The little verse that he finds on the lead casket tells him, turn you where your lady is and claim her with a loving kiss. But he doesn't claim her. Although a few idiotic editors of Shakespeare have inserted the stage direction, kisses her at that point. The next speech, in fact, Bassanio refuses to do precisely that. He does the opposite of claiming her. He gives the choice back to her. Fair lady, by your leave, I come by note to give and to receive. Like one of two contending in a prize that thinks he hath done well in people's eyes, hearing applause and universal shout, giddy in spirit, still gazing in a doubt whether those peals of praise be his or no. So thrice, fair lady, stand I, even so, as doubtful whether what I see be true, until confirmed, signed, ratified by you. He gives the choice back to Portia. The casket has told him he has won, but he's not claiming the right of victory. He leaves it up to her. Inasmuch as Portia is tied to the caskets, bound to marry whoever chooses right, it is an extraordinarily perceptive and generous thing to do. He has freed the heiress from the lottery and then left her free. If she doesn't like him, if she doesn't ratify his position, he'll pack up and go away. That is giving and hazarding all you have won. This is the generosity of love. Giving the one you love her own choice. And that is the significance of this unrealistic fairy tale.